Hi, Sophie. It's great to have you back in this little mini series.
Hi, Dave. Nice to be here again.
Right. Episode 8. The final episode is, you know, always going to be difficult. So both in terms of, you know, like how do you wrap it up as a series, but then also the actual content. So you have to show all of the science that we've just discussed with Danielle, but also you've got to get across the message of the series. So where did you find the balance between those two, like showing the natural history content, but then also wrapping up the series and giving the messages?
Yeah, so Program 8 was the problem child for sure. Program 3 was the other show I made, and that had a nice, relatively easy and straightforward storyline, really. Once you kind of got your head around everything, it kind of formed itself. 8, however, took a lot longer. And it took a lot longer because it was, well, I was given the last 2.5 million years, which was the smallest time period for a show by a long way. All the other episodes cover, you know, hundreds of millions of years, or if not tens of millions of years. And so this was the sort of dawn of the Ice Age, was where we were going to naturally kind of end Program 7 on a sort of cliffhanger. And then I get from there onwards. So it was a nice start because it's the dawn of the Ice Age. And it's so that has atmospheric and kind of everyone, you can picture that in your mind. But then what narrative you tell and what story you tell. So you've got essentially modern animals by this point, and modern geographical layouts. All the continents are where they are now, give or take, sea level rises and changes. What you don't have now is the loss of a lot of megafauna. So at the beginning of the Ice Age, 2.5 million years ago, there were a lot more exotic land mammals, essentially, and other creatures. Large land animals, basically, that went extinct. But it's really hard in a show to show the absence of something. And so it was a really challenging show to make, not least then also the other part of it you mentioned, which is, you know, summing up the series, tying everything off and bringing a kind of strong message to the series in general. And so it's actually a much more process-driven film because, again, I realized that what has happened in the last 2.5 million years is this expansion and retraction of ice periodically throughout that time. And it happened. The ice sheets grew and contracted, grew and contracted, grew and contracted. And what that did was that put the planet into kind of climate chaos, really. And it's only in the last... since the Holocene, in the last 11,700 years, that we've had this stability in an interglacial period. So what I wanted to do is explain to people this process of glaciation and deglaciation. I don't know, is that the right word?
Yeah.
Deglaciation. It doesn't sound American. Deglaciation. So I wanted to explain glaciation and deglaciation to the audience, which is quite a cerebral concept to get across. So again, then how do you tell that story, but how do you embed creature stories into that in order to kind of pull the audience through? So there's something that they can kind of identify with and little characters that can help tell that story. And I wanted to obviously do, you know, your big charismatic Ice Age creatures. When everyone thinks of an Ice Age, it's got to be woolly mammoths. So again, I knew I had to do woolly mammoths, and they coexisted with cave lions. But they were expensive. It was the most expensive complex sequence, VFX sequence in the whole series. So all my money went on to that. And so that is the only big VFX sequence in Program 8. But that's okay, because then the rest of the time period, I could get away more with filming modern stuff to tell the story. So that left me with sort of trying to explain glaciation, and then what that does is that uses up all the planet's water. It sort of held up in all the ice and it dried the planet out, which is really surprising, kind of flip side to an ice age, if you like, is that, you know, it actually got a lot drier. And I didn't realize, this really surprised me, that the Congo in Africa almost disappeared. And of course our our sort of closest living relatives, if you like, the chimpanzees who were in the Congo, are in the Congo, unbeknownst to them, you know, if the Congo had gone, they would have been totally wiped out and made extinct. You know, that the Congo just would have ceased to exist. So, but we'd left our sort of ancestor had already left the forest by that point. So that's another story point I wanted to tell. I knew I had to cover humans in this episode. Like, how on earth do you do that? How do you get from mammoths and the beginning of the Ice Age through to humans? And one thing I think we were keen not to do, the VFX supervisor, Jonathan, was just like, it wouldn't be very good to try and recreate a hominid of sorts, a bipedal ape, ancestor ape, because they're so like us that there's just, the human eye just picks up that they're just not real. And so they become, right. it really pulls you out of the moment. I don't know if you've watched any of those those films that have tried in the past, but they're laughable, really, the sort of hominid type creatures that are brought back to life.
Mm. I mean, you only have to look at computer games and the amount of money and tech and films as well that goes into creating humans. You're right. You can spot it a mile off, and within 5 years, it's laughable. Some attempts that may seem amazing at the time. So,
and they feel bionic, don't they? There's just a quality about it. Yeah. So we just decided that we're not going to go there. So when we bring humans into the story, it had to be sapiens, you know, modern humans. Even though we do recreate in the film a kind of Native American sequence of showing off really how incredible humans were as hunter-gatherers and how incredibly intelligent they were as hunters. So that transition, that the story of us really, I told through baboons, because again, I felt chimps was the natural one. I think one of my bosses wanted me to do chimps, but I kind of made the argument that actually chimps do what we didn't do. Chimps stayed in the Congo. They stayed in the arboreal forest and the jungle, and they didn't leave it. Whereas baboons did do what our ancestors did. They left the jungle and the forest, and they went out onto the open plains with all the other big scary creatures that were out there. And so they're much more, their lifestyle and how they live more is much more akin. Okay, they're not bipedal, but where they live now and the niche that they exist in now was what our ancestors would have had to have gone through. Mm. Well, we kind of stepped out of the arboreal lifestyle and then went down onto the forest floor and into the savannas and became bipedal. So I chose to use baboons to kind of tell that story or hint at that story of that's what we did. And then the next time you meet a primate in the show, it is us, it's humans. And there's a nice twist that we got in where you think it's because Native Americans dressed up as wolves as a hunting strategy. They put wolf skins over them as cloaks and pretended to be wolves. And so there's a lovely reveal moment where you peel back the hood of this wolf cloak and that's where you see a human for the first time in the show. So that was actually cut. The whole of the end of the series, we didn't want to leave that to last minute. I didn't want to get into the cutting room right at the end. So these films, you know, you spend most of the time in pre-production, researching, and then the filming period. And then once your filming period is finished, you hit the edit and then you deliver the show. And I didn't want to be in a situation where we get into the edit and we don't have what we need, or we're not quite sure how to tell it. And, you know, I didn't want to leave that to last minute. So as lockdown happened that week, the COVID pandemic hit the UK and we were literally told to go home and not come back on the Monday morning. We were cutting the end to the series then. And so I wrote the words first and we were sent home during the pandemic, which was crazy in itself because it felt really apt because it was felt very apocalyptic at the time. I think if you remember, we didn't even know how dangerous COVID was. I think we all thought potentially if you caught it, you could die. You know, I mean, many did die, but how just, you know, I guess how virulent it was and we just didn't know. So that was kind of crazy. We were in the cutting room cutting the end of the series. We were sent home with COVID, and then we continued to cut it. And that cut, I watched it back the other day, actually. I mean, it hasn't really changed. And we swapped out a lot of the shots because we used archive to cut it, and then we slowly replaced. And that's how we knew what to film for it. But it's a very tightly constructed, tightly cut. I mean, Nigel Buck, the editor, has done an incredible job with it. And we knew a few parameters. I knew that I wanted to have an impactful end to the show. I knew that I wanted people to see the sixth mass extinction in a new way. And by new way, I mean the lens of loop, we call it. So by now, the viewers have watched 7 hours worth of the history of life on Earth. You know, they should have a really good understanding of, you know, when life evolved, how it evolved, what the kind of arms races were that were going on, what all the big mass extinction events were, what caused those mass extinction events. They should have picked up that CO2, you know, raises temperatures, and that has caused, certainly the Permian extinction was a CO2 related sort of runaway effects that happen with that as a result. And so I really wanted, with all of that learning, to kind of reflect back on the series, to kind of throw back to these past extinction events, and so that people can see the present day in the context of the past. And I think that's really important, because I don't think that's really been done before for a mass audience. You know, I think everyone bangs the drum of the sixth mass extinction. We all know about it. We all know that climate change is a thing. We all know that the planet is warming. We all know all this stuff, but you kind of get a bit numb to it. And so I was keen not to take that approach. I didn't want to kind of preach to people. I just wanted to kind of be quite matter of fact about it, that we're in it, it's happening. And what the result is at the end of it, like how we come out of it, who knows? But what we do know from the past is that the dominant species going into mass extinction never come out of it.
Yeah. And I really do see the importance of having that message at the end of this series, the putting it into the context of the whole of the history of life on the planet, which you don't get in other series, as you said. Was that message always intended to be in the show, or was that something that you brought to it?
Depends which version of the show. I think before we really got our teeth into knowing what the show was going to be, I think it was, before I was brought on board, it was sort of, it kind of stopped at chimpanzees and it didn't even feature humans. And then I came on board, and then it was, and then we found out which shows we were given, and I was given episode 8, and I said, well, I'm not making the show if it doesn't have humans in it. You know, you can't tell the story of evolution of life on Earth and not feature humans and the sixth mass extinction. So, yeah, I basically was like, yeah, that was my kind of, not threat, but I luckily Dan Tapster, the producer, was totally on board with that when he came on board. Dan Tapster's the series producer of the show, and he came on board and he was totally behind that, totally backed that, and really got it. And he also knew how important that was going to be for the series. So, yeah, he was great in that he just let me kind of roll with it, and he helped facilitate the edit and to make sure that we edited it early so that we could really craft it and we had the time to craft the end and get it right, really. So, yeah, I think it was very, certainly to me anyway, it was very clear that the series needed to have a strong resonance at the end of it, just because I think you wouldn't do the story of life justice if you didn't, you know.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
And completely, it is remarkable. Agree. Like, I remember reading the book, you know, the Ends of the World, is it, or the Ends of the Earth?
Nope.
I think it's called End of the World or something, but it's a really well-written book. And I remember reading that book, and it basically puts humans into perspective, because the planet is halfway through its life, or the sun is, you know. So the Earth, we're halfway through the kind of journey of life, if you like, and it's going to end with a hot, dried up planet without water on it again. you know, that is the fate of our planet. That's just what's going to happen. And so the kind of the story that we're at the moment, whilst we're really self-important and we think we put ourselves at the in the center of everything in our world, we're actually quite insignificant. And I think that's a really powerful thought, is that, and the other powerful thought is that the fact that we can actually sit here and reflect on all of this past history, the fact that we're intelligent enough to understand what's gone on in the past is unique. And that's a really an amazing thing to understand, is that we can sit here fully aware of what we're doing to the planet, but also fully aware of the history lessons from the past. And I think if that's not a kick up the backside, do something about it, then what is? Like, if you can't watch this series and think, God, we know all of this, we know the hard factual science, and we know what CO2 does, and we know that increasing it does to the planet, and we've seen all these mass extinction events happen in the past, and we've got all this incredible knowledge from the scientific community about past mass extinction events, and to sit there in full knowledge of all of that and not do something about it is criminal, really.
Yeah. So I'll like to unpack a couple of things in what you've just touched upon there. So firstly, though, I want to know what the difficulty of delivering that message was in terms of, well, there's so much that goes into climate change, and this is it's politics, it's policy, it's opinions, it's denialism. There's so much that goes into it. How do you frame this in a way that isn't pointing the finger, or do you frame it in a way that points 7.8 billion fingers? How do you address it in a way that, I mean, you're working for Silverback Films, you're working for Netflix, they're working for their shareholders. There's a whole lot of people that have opinions on this.
There are, but you know what? It was really unified our end, and including with Netflix and with the support from Silverback, from Netflix, from everyone. Again, mapping out the parameters to the end of the show, I was like, can we just be very matter of fact about it? Can we just, you know, we don't sort of beat around the bush of like, are we in deliberating whether or not we're in the sixth mass extinction? We are in the sixth mass extinction. And it was really refreshing to have that support to just be like, yeah, that's fine. Just go with you. We're not here sitting here debating whether or not, you know, CO2 is climbing, whether or not the planet is getting warmer. It is getting warmer. CO2 levels are rising. We know from the past what that does. It is happening. What the outcome is, we don't know. But, you know, and so it was kind of, it was very clear that everyone was on board, certainly editorially, with that. And it was really refreshing, actually, to not have to, as a filmmaker, be grey about it, because that would have been a real kind of a real shame to have to sort of, in any way, pull back from that. And, you know, I remember when I first started my career at the BBC, you had to be impartial. You couldn't say that, and you had to show the other view and to climate change. And it's just all rubbish, because the other view is such a minority view. It's a tiny fraction of people. The vast, overwhelming evidence from the scientific community and the scientific agreement is that climate change is a thing and it's human caused. And so to be able to kind of just run with that is just, it means you, it lifts a lot of chains, you know, off you, that you, and enables you to just get on with it, really, and just get on with the bigger message. And the bigger message is more powerful, I think, because it isn't about, it's about that bigger timescale message. It transcends the sort of present almost, because it's not really about, are we, aren't we, any of that stuff. It's more about, we're headed in this direction. What does that mean for us? And what does that mean for the rest of the life on our planet? And that, to me, is a much greater thought. And if people can get into that headspace watching the end of the show, and people can question themselves what that means, then that's a job well done. And that's what I try to do in my films, is I like to have an active, I sort of active versus passive viewer. I like the viewers watching my films, especially the ends to them, to put them into a headspace where they're actively questioning themselves and thinking thoughts and having a talking point. So they turn around to the person next to them and have a conversation. You know, I don't want someone to just be like, oh, that's a nice program. They switch off and write, what's for dinner? You know, I want people to be sat there chatting, thinking, and, you know, that influences their sort of thoughts, if you like, because it's kind of affected them, hopefully. I mean, not in a bad way, but in a good way.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you about was that you did give it a positive in that we are given a ray of hope, in that we are aware as a species what's happening. We know about the impending disaster. But here we are again discussing the ways in which we can deliver this message. And this isn't the first documentary that's given this message. So are documentaries being heard? Are they effective as a platform for this message if we keep on needing to tell people about it?
I hope so. Otherwise, I might as well just give up. I don't know. I think, do you know what I think it comes down to more is the fabric of human nature, really. I remember watching years ago, it was early 2000s, I think, there was a wild screen event, which is like our sort of industry Oscars, if you like, for within the wildlife community. And it was televised, amazingly. Back then it was a discussion panel with Richard Dawkins. Is it Richard Dawkins? Yeah, the Selfish Gene guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a discussion panel with Richard Dawkins, Leakey, I can't remember his first name, that's awful. And Jane Goodall, David Attenborough. And the title of it was called The Selfish Green. And the question on the panel was, are we too selfish to do anything about the climate and the situation we're in? Now, bearing in mind, this was, you know, 25 years ago, almost a long time ago. And it was fascinating. And it basically said, obviously, because Dawkins was there because of his book, The Selfish Gene. And it's just like that short-termism that we have as organisms. Our biology is set up to kind of be immediate. You know, we need to feed ourselves. We need to look after our family and raise our young and do those things. And we haven't lost that. Those are important things to us for survival. But can we think long-term? Is it possible to think long-term? The politics around policy change and people wanting to be voted in and how we've constructed our political systems, all of these things, you know, fascinating questions about the fabric of society, about human nature and how that feeds into it, about politics, about survival, about biology, you know, it's all interwoven. And I don't know, the pessimist in me says, yes, we are too selfish to do anything about it, that we do work on that level. But then the optimist in me says, well, you know, we have transcended a lot of our biology and we can do something about it if we want to. And we have got the resources and the intelligence. And so I feel that it would be wrong to write it off just yet. And I genuinely hope that when faced with a disaster, that humans do pull through and that we do club together and put our differences aside and sort it out. I worry that it's bigger than that, because I worry that, you know, once the sort of CO2 wheel is in motion, if you like, on a sort of physical level, that runaway impact of that is huge. I mean, that is something that life on our planet taught me, was just how massive mass extinctions are. And I know that sounds silly. They're not called mass extinctions for no good reason. They're mass extinctions because at least 70% of all species get wiped out. And I thought, oh yeah, but humans will be fine. You know, we'll find a way. We're creative. We can live on the moon. You know, I don't know. We can't live on the moon, but we've we're incredibly resourceful. You know, we've got people living on permanent bases now down in Antarctica. So if climate does get really hot, surely we can just build ourselves a shelter somehow, grow our stuff inside, and some of us will survive that future. But what you don't realize is that actually, if the world warms and the plants die and the whole ecosystem goes out of balance and that affects the oxygen, you know, all these massive, huge ecosystem level disasters happen. And I think I was a bit ignorant and unaware of that until I started reading up about the Permian mass extinction. And so I don't know. I think I'm very mixed. I think I definitely have hope, because I think if you don't have hope, what's the point? And I think it is important to keep telling these stories. And I think it is important to try and get through to people. And I think the more people hear it, the more that the general knowledge of what is happening is accepted. And then the more that people might stand to kind of start to find a way out of it, or a way to kind of navigate through it. Cause I'm not sure you can necessarily find a way out of it. But you've got to inspire the next generation to want to solve all these problems, because if you don't, then, you know, what hope is there? So I guess I sort of swing between pessimism and optimism, but I think you've got to be hopeful.
I would love to talk to you about this for ages and ages, but I probably end up saying some really stupid stuff. Who knows? But we'll do that after this. We'll save everyone from that conversation. But it is really interesting, and yeah, having that influence what goes into a documentary and the kinds of things, the messages that you want to get across. You ended the documentary in an interesting way by projecting a little into the future, into a possible future, in that London's underwater, and presumably humans are gone, but life continues. Is that a positive or a negative ending for the series, for our planet and for life?
You know, it was deliberately crafted that way. Again, I liked the idea of the ambiguity. I liked the way that people, you're not telling people what to think. You're showing them something, and then it's up to them to make a decision on it. So again, it was left a little bit open, because I wanted people to kind of bring their own future into their minds of what they think it might be based on what they've learned. I mean, where do I think it's sat? I mean, I think it's a world without humans, but that of course life will continue. I mean, we've only been here a blink of an eye in terms of the story of the evolution of life on Earth. So yeah, lichen are going to be here. And that's why I wanted to put dragonflies back in the spotlight, because they're amazing. They have been here for 350 million years. And I think they'll continue to be here after we're gone. So I kind of like that, in a way. We sort of purge the planet of ourselves, and there's a sort of pathetic fallacy, if you like, to our own existence in a way. But it's sort of, I don't know, in a way I'm at peace with that. You know, I'm at peace with the sort of that being the future and that being the end to our story. So I don't know. That's what I hope. I hope that people kind of write their own story in their head, really. And where did you think? I mean, what did you take away? Did you assume it meant no humans?
I did, yeah. I mean, I again, would humans be okay? Would there be some refugia or underground bunker like you see in so many sci-fi shows or whatnot? Would there be any holdout of them, or does the whole ecosystem that humans need to survive, does that all fundamentally change? It's so hard to say. It's so hard to know.
I mean, it's weird, isn't it? Because I think we're so reliant now on globalization. And by that, I mean, I guess, the system. And if the system falls down, I think the vast majority of humans will fall down. Like, I think, but like you say, there will probably be vestigial units of humans that can work outside of that and make ends meet somewhere on the planet. I mean, sea levels will rise, so that will cut off a lot of the land. But Yeah, it's an interesting thought process to put yourself into that headspace and think about it. And that's just all I hope that people will take away actually from the end of the series is to just give it some thought.
Well, I'm pretty sure that everyone listening to this is going to be giving it quite a bit of thought after this discussion. But let's bring it back down and reduce the scale a little bit just to this series. So in general, were you very happy with the end product?
Really happy. I mean, this has been by far the most challenging series I've ever worked on for so many reasons. I think the learning curve academically was exponential. Like, I've learned so much more about the history of life on Earth, and that informs, it makes your life so much richer in so many ways. And that sounds really like corny to say that, but understanding how the planet works and how life evolved and the mass extinction events, it just, that information just makes you see the world in a totally new way. And makes you appreciate the world in a totally new way. Like, I have a much greater appreciation for the small things in life, the dragonflies and the lichen and the moss. And just marvel at how life persists, the persistence of life. I mean, and it's all sort of, you know, it just exists because it can, and yet it does. And I think that's a remarkable thing. And of course, you know, there was a huge VFX learning. Most of us going into this had never done VFX before. So I'm really proud, actually, of that achievement of getting your head around VFX and, you know, producing top class VFX sequences that look incredible, that are different, that no one's done before. They're shot in a style, you know, DP Jamie McPherson was brought on board and was instrumental in the look and style of the VFX sequences and the series. And I think that genuinely we've created a piece of television that is remarkable in so many ways, with so many talented people coming together to produce this series from just such diverse backgrounds globally, you know. And I think that is a huge, huge undertaking. And, it, you know, it was 5 years. Well, longer than that if you include all the pre-production, but I was on it for 5 years. So yeah, I'm super, super proud of what the team's pulled off. And I'm just excited. I'm really excited for it to go out. I'm excited for people to kind of watch and learn. And I'd love, you know, feedback. I'd love to hear what people think about the end of the series and whether they think it's humans are there or not and what they make of it. So yeah, really excited.
All right. Well, thank you so much for talking us through your contribution and the series. I've really enjoyed speaking to you.
Yeah, likewise. And I just hope that it sort of, the scientists don't kind of, I don't know what's the right word, that it doesn't kind of, you know, I think it is a very accurate depiction of kind of that big story. And I hope that kind of people agree, I guess. I guess I secretly hope it'll be used in things like schools and lectures and lecture theatres for years to come, but I don't know. We will see.
We'll see. Right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave.